All right, I think we're ready now. So let's just start by reading the passage. And we're in Matthew chapter 16, verses 13 through 19. And John, would you mind starting us off tonight?
13 through 19. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." "What about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven."
Thank you. All right, so that's the main passage we're looking at tonight, and there's a lot of cross-references here for these scriptures. And we were on the second bullet, which shows all the three, there's actually three genealogies of Christ. And I think we looked at, last week, we kind of looked at Matthew 1 through 17. And that is the genealogy that you'll find. If you look at your genealogy chart, that's the one that you'll find in the second column. That's the second column. And as I've mentioned last week, if you study these genealogies from a theological perspective, understanding the three natures of Christ, or the four, you could say the four natures of Christ, you have an absolute masterpiece. You know, we talk about the magnum opus of a particular composer, or a magnum opus of a painter, and they have their great masterpiece, like the Mona Lisa, or Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, or something along those lines. Well, this genealogy of Christ is just one of God's many masterpieces, and it is an absolute wonder and a miracle how precise and accurate it is. And we did this pretty much in depth in those first few sessions, so I don't want to go into it in that detail. But I just would like to point out a few things from that session. First of all, if you look, you'll see that in the second column of Matthew's genealogy, you'll see that it's split up into three sections, and I went ahead and I circled them blue, purple, and red. And those are the three groupings that are listed in Matthew 1 through 17. And they're three groups of 14 each. And so again, we went over that last week. Some people think, well, then there should be 42. And there's only 41. But that's the reason there's 41 is because David's counted twice. And that's why he's circled by the blue and by the purple. So,
just for future reference, that should be, it's not Bathsheba, it's Bathsheba, B-A-T-H.
Oh, got a typo there?
Yeah.
Thank you.
But it's funny.
So, really? That one's correct?
Yeah, so is mine.
I've got B-A-T-H,
yeah. I swear,
mine has it too. Okay. Mine has it too, so I must have.
God corrected it on the right.
I must have thrown an A in there somewhere. Okay. Accidentally, I apologize.
Don't see it on this.
So, but anyway, that, you know, the blue, I use that to symbolize kind of the priestly line, or the, you know, that aspect of Abraham. But then, you know, David, the purple, kind of going into the royal line, and then the red I just used as the sacrificial symbol color. symbolic color there. But the interesting thing here is that you'll notice on the left that there's several names left out. If you go to the left, you'll notice like Ahaziah, Athaliah, Joash, and Amaziah. You'll notice that those are left out of the genealogy here in the second column. And they're left out very intentionally because those were some extremely wicked people. And God actually, if you go and you look where those are, you know, I gave the scripture references for each one, like 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 2 Kings, where all those accounts are. And if you go in and you read them, God even talks about how he's going, you know, those people are going to be, you know, forgotten or even removed from the record, so to speak. And so you can see they're removed as if they weren't even there in Matthew's genealogy. He just skips over them. And we went over, when we first started those first few months, we went over the genealogy. We talked about Athaliah, who was actually a wicked queen who tried to usurp power, and she tried to kill every single male child that was an heir of Judah. And so what you'll see if you study this genealogy very carefully is you'll see all the way back from the beginning, remember in Genesis chapter 3, God says, God pronounces the curse, and he starts with the serpent, and he says, because of you have done this, cursed are you more than all cattle and more than every beast of the field. And on your belly shall you go, and dust shall you eat all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. And he, speaking of the woman's seed, Christ, he shall crush you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel. So right there, the woman's seed is prophesied to be the Messiah. And so what do you have right after that in Genesis chapter 4? Eve says, Adam knew his wife, Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain. And she said, I have gotten a man from the Lord. In other words, they were expecting, here's the prophecy, here's the Messiah, right away. Cain, they were expecting, that kind of they thought, well, it's going to be from my seed, it's going to be Cain. And so what happens? Cain, immediately, not immediately, actually, they were probably, it's likely that they were between 30 to 40 years old when this happened, when Cain killed Abel. But you have Cain going and saying, he brings an offering to the Lord, and Abel brings an offering to the Lord, and the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering, but for Cain and for his offering, he had no regard. So Cain became very angry, and his countenance fell. Right? And the Lord said, why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will not it be lifted up? But if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you. In other words, and God says, but you must master it. And so right away, sin is crouching at the door of Cain's conscience and waiting to pounce. And that jealousy that he felt over his offering not being accepted and Abel's was, and he tells Abel all about what God said, and he rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. So right away, Abel's killed, and then Cain has the black mark on his record of being a murderer. And so in the end of Genesis chapter 4, you have, and the man knew his wife again, and she conceived and bore Seth. And it says, and she called his name Seth, for God hath appointed me another seed in place of Abel. In other words, Seth is going to be the new line, the replacement for now that Cain is marred, Abel's gone, and so now the line is going to go through Seth. And that's what you'll see. You'll see that here on your sheet. If you go in the third column, you see in the third column where it goes from Adam at the very top, and then to Seth. And so now Seth is carrying the messianic seed, that promise, the promise of the Messiah. That's being carried through Seth. And so what you'll see then, very shortly thereafter, by the time we get to Noah, it talks about how, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. and the Nephilim are on the earth in those days, and afterwards when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and bore to them, and those were the mighty men of old, men of renown. And so those are, you know, those mighty men of old, men of renown, those are the half-breeds, the Nephilim, not eligible for salvation. And it's Satan's attempt to corrupt this gene pool, to thwart the plan of God to bring the Messiah through the seed of the woman. And so this whole gene pool gets mixed up with all these fallen angels having offspring with human women. And then it gets down to the point where Noah is the only one left who has 100% human DNA. He's the only one left on the planet. Him and his three sons are the only ones. It says a lot of generations will say he was right, a righteous man, blameless, but the actual word is perfect. It says perfect in his generations. And what that really means is he was the only one left that carried the genuine human seed.
Well, and his wife, too.
Right. Yeah, they were the only ones that carried the genuine human seed. And so you see Satan's plan to attack the gene pool, to throw off the plan of God. And then so that's when God sends the flood. And then you have Noah at that point, him and his three sons. Then it goes through them, and it's going through Shem now. And then later on, God reveals that it's going to be through Abraham, right? Abraham is going to be the one. And then a little bit after Abraham, he reveals that it's going to be through Judah. Judah is going to be the messianic one. And so what you'll see as that gets revealed throughout Genesis, you'll see Satan start focusing and zeroing in his attack on this particular lineage. And he'll say, okay, Judah lineage, I need to squash this lineage. Because Satan's attempt is always to thwart the plan of God. And so you'll see, if you follow this genealogy through the scriptures, all through the Old Testament, you just go through and you'll see Satan fine-tunes his attack when God reveals more and more about where the Messiah is going to come from. And he just keeps fine-tuning and zeroing in on, now it's going to be through David. David's going to be the one. So you'll see Satan's attacks come on David very heavily at that point. And so as you follow this genealogy throughout the Bible, it's amazing. It's a really, really neat study. And the interesting thing about it is that when you get down to, you'll notice that in the second column, at the end of the purple bracket, where it says Josiah was a righteous king, but unfortunately, he wasn't the best of fathers because his two sons, if you look at them, they're to the left. Okay? Well, his son and his grandson. You have Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim, and then the great-grandson, Jehoiachin, or Jeconiah, or Coniah. He goes by three different names. There was a blood curse pronounced on him. A curse that said, God literally comes down and tells this person, Jeconiah, or Jehoiachin, however you want to pronounce it. As a matter of fact, the Coniah right there, Coniah, you see that version of his name?
Mm-hmm.
That's after he was cursed, because Jeh comes from Jehovah. It was, in other words, he had the name of God attached to his name, like God, just like Daniel. El means God, Dan means judge, so Daniel means God is my judge. So Coniah, I'm not sure what Coniah means, I can't remember, but Jeconiah meant that his name had some, he was supposed to be destined to have something to do with God by his name. You know, God was part of his name. And when God pronounces the curse on him, God literally tells him, you know, you're no longer called Jeconiah. In other words, I don't want to have my name having anything to do with you. You're now just, all you are now is Coniah. Because my name is not attached to yours in any way anymore. And he pronounces a blood curse on Jeconiah because of his wickedness. And at that point, he says, no one shall prosper, no one shall prosper from your lineage, ever, for all time. And so at that point, Satan must have been rejoicing in the counsels of, you know, his demons and fallen angels, because he's saying, okay, the Messiah has to come from the line of Judah, through David, through the royal line, the kingly line, and now this Jeconiah person has a blood curse on him, saying no one who comes from him shall ever prosper. Ever. So, Satan must have been thinking, I've won. There's no way. You know, I've got God over a barrel now. There's no way that his prophecy can come true. However, remember, it's the seed of the woman. It's the seed of the woman. And so, when you go through that genealogy, what you'll find is it goes all the way, Jeconiah, Joseph, from Joseph and Mary, you know, Mary's Joseph, is actually of the lineage of Jeconiah, or Jehoiachin. He's of that lineage. And you'll notice he wasn't very prosperous. You know, he was just a poor carpenter, and we know that he didn't live very long. He died at a relatively young and early age. And so he wasn't very prosperous, and this whole line of people right here was under that curse. You know, they had a blood curse on them. But Jesus didn't come from the bloodline of Joseph. He came from the Immaculate Conception by the power of the Holy Spirit. And so the interesting thing there is if you go back to David and Bathsheba, if you look at that, you'll see from David, under David and Bathsheba comes Solomon, but also from David and Bathsheba comes Nathan. Nathan. And Nathan is another one of their sons, but Nathan is not of the royal line because he's not going to inherit the throne. But he carries the bloodline. But he carries a bloodline that isn't cursed. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have the cursed bloodline on him. So when you have that non-cursed bloodline, then you go through from David, and you see David goes all the way down to Eli. And in the Bible, it'll say, if you look at this in the Bible, in Luke's Gospel account, when it says Eli there, Eli, it says, was then the father of Joseph. And what it means when it says that is he was the father-in-law. He was the father-in-law of Joseph. In other words, he was Mary's father. That was Mary's father. So he was the father-in-law of Joseph. And so that goes to Mary. And then Mary is born or Jesus Christ is born of Mary, the Virgin, the seed of the woman, by the overshadowing of the Holy Spirit. And so you can kind of see, you know, how God has worked this masterpiece of bringing the Messiah into the world against Satan's zeroing in, focused attack, you know, coming closer and closer. Like, you know that Satan was working through Athaliah, the queen, because her job was to eliminate every single male child from that was still alive of the lineage of Judah and David. And that was her goal, was to wipe them all out. And it gets down to the point where there's just one child left. And there's only one left. And there's people that hide him from her. And then God brings it about later on that she's defeated and that son then carries on. But you see the drama there? You know, the lineage, everything that God had prophesied came down to just one person left. There was only one person. And so you can see how dramatic inspiring that is, that how heavily Satan has attacked God's plan from the very beginning, and how God always overcomes it. And so...
Is he an evil man like his father and grandfather?
Yes. Kaniah. Jeconiah. That's the one that God pronounced the blood curse on him because of how wicked he was.
Okay.
And God actually took... The reason he's called Kaniah is because...
He took the J.
Took the J. Like God says, you're not going to be called anything to do with my name. Your name is going to be Kaniah now.
Well, I guess I'm just wondering if it wasn't a little harsh to curse everyone from that line.
Well, God has his purposes.
Because Joseph was supposed to be a good man.
Yeah, he was. And they had a blood curse. The blood curse wasn't that they weren't going to go to heaven, or they didn't have the opportunity for salvation. The curse was, and you can go read about it.
No, that's okay. I mean, I can see where it is.
Yeah, the curse was that no one from your lineage will prosper on the throne of David. that's the curse. In other words, the Messiah is supposed to come from that lineage. And how can the Messiah prosper on the throne of David if that's what all the prophecies say, when now there's a blood curse in that line? But Jesus didn't come from the bloodline, but he legally, as Joseph's adopted son, he legally inherits all rights to the throne. So he was legitimately Joseph's adopted son, not his blood son, but his adopted son. So he was legally entitled to inherit the throne of David while not having the blood curse on him. And at the same time, he's also of the bloodline of David through Nathan going down to Mary. So every single way you slice it, you can just kind of see how, you know, that's just a tiny little snippet of how amazing this is. I mean, we could spend another 4 weeks just on this alone, but we'll move on. So the main thing that I would like you to get from this stuff, and the reason that I bring it out again, is because the four Gospels paint four different portraits of Christ. And Matthew paints Christ as the Messiah, the Mashiach Magid, the Messiah, the King of Israel. And so Jesus is going to be the Messiah, the King of Israel, and that's Matthew's primary purpose, is to prove that. So Matthew's genealogy goes from Abraham, the beginning of the Jews, through to David, beginning the royal line, and then the royal line going down to Jesus, Jesus being entitled to inherit the royal lineage, the royal line of David, being the adopted son of Joseph. Then, the other role of Jesus, as detailed in Mark's account, is as the servant, the suffering servant. Jesus is the servant, and he is represented there as the ox, or the ensign of one of the tribes of Israel that bore their ensign as the ox, and he was the servant. He's the servant king. And as a servant, no one is ever interested in the pedigree of a servant, right? And so Mark is the only gospel that has no genealogy. There is no genealogy in Mark, because you don't care about the pedigree of a servant. You don't care where they came from, they're just a servant. But he's a servant king. Matthew is ensign, is the lion, you know, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the king, the kingly one. Mark paints Christ as the ox, or the servant, suffering servant, king. And in Mark, Mark is all about this. The most prominent word in Mark is straightway, or immediately. You'll see that over and over again in Mark. It'll say Jesus straightway, or Jesus immediately he went and he helped these people. Or somebody had a problem, and it'll say immediately Jesus got up and went to help them, or heal them. And so it just constantly says immediately, 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 just like a servant. You know, like beck and call. He's always on point, ready to serve. And then Luke paints the portrait of Christ as the Son of Man, his humanity, showing Christ's humanity, how he felt. And it reads very much like a story. And the most common phrase in Luke so it came to pass. And so it came to pass. And it came about, depending on which translation you use. And it came about that Jesus did this. And then it came about that he did that. And it reads very much like a human story. And Luke is the doctor, the physician. And he's also the Gentile. He's the only Gentile writer of the New Testament. So you have...
Luke was a Gentile? That's right. Gentile, he was Greek, doctor, wasn't he?
So he was the only man. You know, Gentile associated with a non-spiritual, you know, Gentiles were the non-spiritual, the non-Jews. And so you can kind of see he's like Luke represents that side of Jesus, the man, the humanity of him. And so who better to write about that than a Gentile physician? And he shows Jesus' compassionate side, his human side, his human nature, how he felt. There's more about that in Luke than any other. And the interesting thing about Luke's genealogy is, what does it do? It goes from his bloodline, right, his human bloodline from Mary, all the way back to every single descendant, all the way back to Adam. 77 generations. And that's an interesting thing. I really like what Pastor Bob's sermon was about the taking the Bible seriously yesterday. I love that, because if you take the Bible seriously, you cannot read Luke's genealogy, and you cannot look at other things in the Bible and saying that all Scripture is inspired by God, and still try to somehow marry these ideas of evolution and well, somehow it all works together, because Jesus said from the beginning he created them man and woman, male and female, from the beginning. At the very beginning of creation, Adam was there. And then from Adam to Jesus, there's 77 generations. That's 4,000 years. Any way you slice it, there's no way of getting around it. So, you know, you can try to, you know, espouse those ideas of trying to figure out ways that creation equals vast ages of this, that, or the other. But then in Exodus, it says, in 6 days God created the world. And the word used for day there is yom. And that means a 24-hour period of time, a 24-hour day. So, you know, if you take the Bible seriously, then it wipes out just a whole bunch of stuff that the general popular culture tries or believes strongly in, and a lot of Christians try to figure out a way to, you know, well, there's some way this all fits together, but no, it's that part, you know, what the world is saying is just a bold-faced, flagrant lie. So, anyway, let's move on to the next column. The last column shows Christ's third genealogy and his most important genealogy, I believe, where it says, and the Word was with God and the Word was God. In other words, you know, Jesus was the Son of God, therefore, you know, if zebras have children, they have zebras. Not cheetahs. Cheetahs have babies, they have cheetahs. Humans have children, they have humans. And so if God has a children, he's going to have God. You know, it's, you impart the nature of who you beget onto who you beget. You know, your nature is the nature of the begotten, who's begotten. So, you know, a great mystery, of course, we're talking about the Trinity, but it's extremely important, because you have to, you know, some people will go into some weird diatribes about this, trying to figure out, you know, how all that works, but, and the worst one, the one that I'm most upset about, is when people try to say, well, Jesus was the firstborn of creation, so he's the first thing that God created, and that is 100% wrong, because Jesus, it says, was the firstborn, and what the word there, the Greek word, is protokos. Protokos. And protokos in Greek means preeminent. In other words, he wasn't the first created thing. He was the firstborn of creation. Protokos meaning he was preeminent. He's the preeminent one over all creation. That's what it actually means. And so he's not the first thing created. He is the creator. John goes on to talk about how he's the co-creator. Nothing came into being without him. So you have a paradox there if you say God created Jesus first, because there's a paradox, because it says nothing that was created, you know, has come into being did not come but from him. So how could he create himself through himself if he didn't exist yet? It's a paradox. It doesn't work. You know, Jesus was not created. He was born of God. He was born of God, begotten of God. And the reason I'm so upset about that is because if you think about it in those terms, that Jesus was the first created thing or person, then it's kind of like saying, you know, well, I'm the creator, I'm God the Father, so, ooh, I have this big problem now with this rebellion, so I'm gonna create someone to go and take the punishment and the suffering, and I'm gonna go and I'm gonna let that person whom I created go and take care of it. You know, like I could create another one if I wanted to, if you see what I mean. Whereas if you have a son that comes from you, and it's the most important thing and the most important person in your entire life, and that's the person you send, then it's like yourself. You are going and you are taking the sacrifice on yourself through the person of your son. So I think that's critical theology to understand. And very, very, very important to understand that, because it's kind of like saying, you know, if you end up in a mess, well, I'll just create somebody to go take care of it. That's wrong. That is not biblically sound. So, anyway.
You know, the part in John, the Word was God and the Word was with God, the Word is what creates. John Milton read that Jesus was the actual creator of all matter because he was the Word. Well, this goes back to a theory in linguistics between thoughts and words. What would you think came first, the thought or the word?
You would think
the thought came first, but it does not come first. You cannot think something if you don't have a language for it. The language actually creates the thoughts, and that's why our early memories only emerge about the time when we started speaking, because we were able to take chaos in our minds and find, oh, cookie. You know, that's a cookie, and now I know what a cookie is and I can formulate it. That's why, according to the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, Eskimos can perceive snow differently from us because they have 100 different words for snow. We only have 3 or 4. We can tell if snow is slushy. We can tell if it's wet. We can tell a few things about snow based on our words. But snow for the Eskimo is so crucial for survival that they can actually perceive snow in a different way than we can because they have so many more words for it. And they can look at snow and tell you a particular patch of snow and tell you so much more about it than we could even begin to perceive. Mm-hmm. So that in some way that kind of works in here, the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis.
And I think that, well, that goes right along with one of the things that Pastor Bob says about Jesus. He borrows it from Blaise Pascal, saying that, you know, Jesus tells us more about God and more about ourselves than anyone else. And, you know, the reason he can, just kind of like you were saying, is because actually being of the very nature of God himself, being God himself, and being fully human at the same time, he's that perfect mediator that can, you know, that acts as that perfect mediator for us between God and man, being equally of both natures. That's the other thing, is to have a perfect diplomat. If you're going to be a diplomat, a successful diplomat, you have to be somehow equally native to both sides that you're trying to enact diplomacy, you know, on behalf of. You know, if you're a little bit more this than you are that, you're not going to be a really successful diplomat. And if you're a little bit more this than you are that, likewise. You know, people aren't going to, you know, they're not going to, on one side or the other, there's going to be mistrust. So to be a perfect diplomat, you have to be equally native to both sides as Christ was. He was equally native to being the nature of God, being of God and God himself, and equally of the nature of man, being born of man through Mary. So, you know, really important here, and that, I know we took a long time to do that, but I think it's very important to go over that, the messianic line, the human line, and the divine line. I think it's important to go over that because, let's look at the passage again. Let's go back to Matthew 16. And if you look at that, and look in Matthew 16, where it says, Jesus is questioning them now. He says, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they go through all the people, you know, who they say. That some people say he is. And then he finally gets down and he says, okay, but who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter answered and said, thou art the Christ. That means Christ meant Messiah. Messianic, he's the Messiah, the messianic line, the royal line. In other words, he's the heir to the throne of David. You're the prophesied king of Israel. So there, he, Simon Peter covers that base, right? And look what he says next. The Son of the Living God. So he covers the divine line, right? And where does all this start off with? Who do people say that the Son of Man is? That's the one Jesus proclaimed. And so Peter, tacitly picking up on that, adding these other two things to him, you have all three. He's the Son of Man, the Son of David, the Messiah King, and the Son of God. And this is the first time in the New Testament when all three come together. People had called him the Son of God before this. People had called him the Messiah before this. He had called himself the Son of Man before this. But this is the first time when you have all three come into focus all at the same time. And that's why Jesus then blesses him and says, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. He revealed this to you." You know, this trifecta of personages that Jesus is. He's the Son of Man, the Son of God, and the Son of David, the Jewish Messianic King. All three, all at once. And I think that's why this right here is so important, because if Jesus just wanted the Son of God part, then you might see that. Just turn back to Matthew chapter 14. Just go back a page. Look back to Matthew 14 real quick. And look at verse 33. This is after he was walking on the water, and he Peter told him to ask him to come out to him, and he did. And they were both walking on the water for a while until Peter started to sink. And then Peter asked him to save me, and Jesus saved him, and then got into the boat. And look at verse 33. And those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "You are certainly God's Son." Okay. Well, why didn't he say at that point to those who said that? Why didn't he say then, "Blessed are you," whoever, Jude, Thaddeus, or
Philip,
or you know, whoever it might have been. "Blessed are you, for flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father in heaven, and you know, upon this I'm going to build my church," and so on and so forth. Why didn't he do it then? Well, that wasn't the whole picture. Yes, he was God's Son for sure, but there's more to it than that. Son of Man, Son of God, Son of David. Or Son of David, Son of Man, Son of God, in a more proper climactic order. So, anyway.
Well, who was Herod? Was he? Did he come down through this curse line?
No. No. Herod is from the Edomites, okay. From Esau. And Herod and all, there's actually six Herods mentioned in Scripture, and there was many more than that. But there's, this was kind of before you joined us, but we were in a detailed line of Herod. There's Herod the Great, who died shortly after Jesus was born. He was the one that slaughtered all the infants.
Great.
Herod the Great, right? And then there was, from him, he had several sons, and you had Herod Antipas, and Herod Philip the Second, and Herod, I can't even remember them all off the top of my head now. But they're all Edomites, and they came into power politically through Rome, but they tried to kind of be semi-Jews. Like even Herod the Great, in particular, tried to be a Jew and actually become a Jew, but he was only a Jew just to please the people. And it was even said, you know, we shared this with the class before you joined us, but it was said of him that it's safer to be Herod's pig than Herod's son, because he was trying to feign Jewishness by, you know, not eating pork and stuff like that. But at the same time, he'd go and murder his sons.
Murder his own kids.
Yeah, if he detected an overthrow plot coming against him.
That's pretty good.
So, anyway, let's move on. Okay, so just wanted to share that with you, and let's read that second bullet, and then we'll move on. The three genealogies of Christ, messianic, human, and divine. Jesus constantly emphasized his human genealogy because his entire mission was to reconcile God and man, and wanted men and women everywhere to feel that he was and is very approachable. He affirmed his deity and messianic credentials several times, but mostly let others proclaim these aspects of his nature and pedigree. So, for instance, let's look at Matthew 23 there. Matthew 23, 12. In other words, Jesus wouldn't go around and call himself, you know, I'm God, you know, bow down, you know, and he didn't have that attitude because he would have been contradicting one of his own teachings. And what's his own teaching? And whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. And who humbled himself more than anyone else in history? Jesus Christ, and he's exalted to the... to where we acknowledge him as God, the Son of God. You know, and he's exalted to the highest level. So
that's the difference between the David Koresh.
Oh, yeah.
Jim Jones and stuff.
They're ridiculous.
Proclaim themselves as the Messiah.
And let's look at Philippians. And anybody have True King James tonight?
You need me to do True King James? On Philippians?
Yeah.
The True King James.
We want the Bible that Jesus used for this.
Yeah, the real Jesus.
There. Where, what do you mean?
Did you notice that when he said that 2 weeks ago, he looked right at Jerry?
Why did he do that?
Because that's when I didn't get those fruits of the Spirit right, because I listened to the King James, he never gave me an A. And finally I said, you know, the Bible that Jesus used was the way I have it.
Well, it's probably the Bible that James II used.
Well, the time I did them, because I did them in red and printed them on the computer and put my name in the bottom in red, and two-thirds of the choir cheated and copied off of my list. I went ahead and did my list, but he gave me an F because I left my cheat sheet in with the others. But he gave all the people that copied it an A, and I never did tell him any difference. But I learned you don't mess with man.
What do you want? We want Philippians chapter 2, verses 6 through 8.
I got it. In the King James Version. Who, being in the form of God, thought it was not robbery to be equal with God, and made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men, and being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross.
So the contentious verse is verse 6 there, whereas in the King James it's rendered. And if you look at the Greek words, there's justification for rendering it either way. But unfortunately, most modern translations render it, I think, in a way that hurts us. Because it gives ammunition to those who would decry the divinity of Christ or question the Trinity or anything like that. It gives them ammunition where I don't think they should have any, because verse 6 should read, if you'll read it again, please.
Who, being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God.
Right there. Jesus, being in the form of God, thought it not robbery. Like, he wasn't taking anything away from God to consider himself equal with God, but emptied himself. And I've used this analogy before. Jesus was not lesser than God the Father in nature. In nature, he's not lesser. Just like, and I cautiously use this example because I even going to this point can be faux pas in a certain way, because, you know, using the example of my father and myself, in nature, there's equality there. We're of the same nature. However, in station only, my father obviously is greater than I, because we are to respect our elders and respect our parents. So in station, greater, yes, in that sense. But in nature, no. And that's why Jesus, as a man, can say, the Father is greater than I. Right? In that passage in John, the Father is greater than I. He's greater than I in station. but in nature it can be equal to him. So we got to balance these scriptures out, because you'll see, you know, anti-divinity of Christ people pull that one out. We'll see Jesus himself said himself, Father is greater than I.
But even
in station, yes. But here Jesus says he thought it not robbery to be equal with God in nature.
Well, the New King James is very close to that.
Yeah.
But even in my New Revised Standard, it said he did not exploit the fact that he was of the nature of God. He did not exploit that fact. He did not think to exploit it, but it still says he was the nature of God.
Yeah. It's just not quite as poignant. That's why I kind of like the King James there for sure. But
I love the King James. It's so wonderful.
Anyway, let's move on to this next part, because this is really interesting. You know, I didn't even know some of this before I researched it, especially the Jeremiah part. Boy, that just blew my mind, and I came across that, and I had never considered it before, and I thought it was really interesting. So if we look at this next passage in Matthew 16, where it says, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they said, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah. And then this is the only one that it actually says the name Jeremiah in Matthew. But that's what's interesting. Still others say Jeremiah or one of the prophets. So, we'll look at the first two. The first two are really easy. Some say John the Baptist. You can go to Mark. It's on your third bullet there. Mark 6, 14 through 16. It says, and King Herod heard of it, for his name had become well known. And he's hearing of Jesus' works, his miracles. And people were saying, John the Baptist has risen from the dead, and that is why these miraculous powers are at work in him. But others were saying, he is Elijah. And others were saying, he is a prophet, like one of the prophets of old. But when Herod heard it, he kept saying, John, whom I beheaded, has risen. For Herod himself had sent and had John arrested and bound in prison on account of Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip, because of him marrying her. And so, we have this passage here where you have this account of people saying, well, it's John the Baptist risen from the dead, and especially Herod. And Herod was extremely superstitious. Okay? And this is not Herod the Great at this point. This is Herod the Great's son.
Antipas.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, is if it's a ruler, if it's a king like he was, and he's saying it, then it must be true.
Yeah. Yeah, and then that spreads it even further. And so, you know, people all over the place were saying John the Baptist was risen from the dead, and they thought he was Jesus. And since John the Baptist was born of
Elizabeth,
Mary's cousin, and it was even said, it is in some Christian tradition, said that John the Baptist and Jesus were very similar in appearance, that they looked similar to each other.
But it couldn't be that because they both knew each other. I mean, there was two people there, not one.
Right, but he was, but John the Baptist was dead at this point.
Yeah. Yes, I know he was
so,
killed. So,
you know, when people are going around, you know, when people who don't know Jesus or John the Baptist,
see,
I guess
they thought he was the same one.
Yeah, it could easily be seen like they looked similar. They bore a family resemblance. So, anyway, let's move on to see where this idea of John the Baptist or Elijah comes from, and that's in Malachi 3:1. In Malachi 4:4-5. So that's the last book in the Old Testament. Some people refer to it as Malachi, the Italian prophet.
Malachi.
Or he could be Irish.
Yeah.
Malachi.
Ah, there you go. There you go. I never heard that one. All right, so Malachi 3:1. Behold, I am going to send my messenger, and he will clear the way before me, and the Lord, whom you seek, will suddenly come to his temple, and the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. So, this was a prophecy in Malachi of John the Baptist. And there's, of course, the other prophecy of John the Baptist in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 3, talking about the one in the wilderness coming to clear the way for the Messiah. And then the interesting thing here in Malachi is it talks about John the Baptist, right? You know, that's a prophecy of John the Baptist. And then notice, and you know how John the Baptist and Elijah are closely linked, right? Because Christ even said, you know, Elijah already has come in type. And what he meant was, you know, the spirit of Elijah already had come in John the Baptist, but they did not listen to him. They did whatever they wanted to him. And so then that's when this comes in. Malachi 4:4-5, and I'm sorry, Carol, if you're in your Jerusalem, you're going to have that same problem you had last time, right?
Yeah, but I've marked it.
You marked it now, yeah. So you're on track.
Yeah.
All right, so didn't think I'd remember that, did you?
Yeah, I know. Thank you.
So if you look at Malachi 4:4-5, it says, remember the law of Moses, my servant, even the statutes and ordinances which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel. Behold, I am going to send you Elijah, the prophet, before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. Now, the Hebrew people didn't understand this two-part mission of the Messiah. That he was going to come and pay the price for sin on the cross. But then he was going to come back and take up his throne, the throne of David, and rule on, and reign on earth. So they didn't understand that twofold message. So when they saw stuff like this, just like we talked about at the beginning, when Adam and Eve thought that Cain, was, oh, I've gotten a man, this is it, this is the Messiah. You know, they thought it was right away. So just the same way that the Jews also thought, okay, well, when all this stuff happens, well, it's confusing, we don't understand all of it, but it's going to, you know, then the Messiah comes, and this is going to happen, and this, and just, it's all going to happen. You know, the apostles even, in Acts, you know, they're asking Jesus all the time, you know, so Israel going to be restored? I mean, what's going on here? I mean, isn't this, you're here, so it's supposed to happen, right? And he's like, it's not for you to know the times and the epochs, you know, appointed and fixed by the Father's authority, right? So, you know, they didn't understand that two-part. So here in Malachi, there's a little prophecy there of John the Baptist coming. But then Elijah is going to come himself later on, and we'll talk more about that when we get to chapter 17 in the Transfiguration, when he's visiting with Moses and Elijah. Anyway, let's get on to this one, because this is the one that really interested me. That's where people were saying John the Baptist, some say Elijah, but here some say Jeremiah. So what's that all about? I kind of never even really noticed that before, so when I got into it and I started studying it, it was really interesting. So let's start this one on the fourth bullet there, and let's go ahead and go to Deuteronomy now. Deuteronomy 18. Deuteronomy 18. We have verses 15 through 22. And Jerry, would you mind reading that one for us tonight?
Okay. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own brothers. You must listen to him. For this is what you ask of the Lord your God at Horeb on the day of the assembly, when you said, let us not hear the voice of the Lord our God, nor see this great fire any more, or we will die. The Lord said to me, what they say is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. I will put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I commanded. If anyone does not listen to my words that the prophet speaks in my name, I myself will call him to account. But a prophet who presumes to speak in my name anything I have not commanded him to say, or a prophet who speaks in the name of other gods must be put to death. You may say to yourselves, how can we know when a message has not been spoken by the Lord? If what a prophet proclaims in the name of the Lord does not take place or come true, that is a message the Lord has not spoken. That prophet has spoken presumptuously. Do not be afraid of him.
All right. So if you look at that, that's actually a prophecy to some degree of Jeremiah himself. And so, and the interesting thing here is, you know, notice how it says that, notice how it says there in verse 15, this is Moses, remember Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy is like a series, one long series of sermons from Moses to the people. It's like the second tone, that's, Deuteronomy means the second tone, do, like, to, duet, or, you know, we have our English language still has remnants of that etymology. But you have Deuteronomy means second telling of the law, or the retelling of the law. So, and Moses is basically recounting the entire story back over again to them through a series of sermons that took place over the course of, don't really know, a couple of days or however long it took. But the interesting thing here is Moses is speaking here, and he says, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me. In other words, Jeremiah, you know, or this prophet who is going to be raised up is going to be like Moses. And so if you look at this chart here, we don't necessarily have to go track every single one of these down, but it might be fun to do some of them. But just let's look at the whole chart first of all. Here's just a few of the similarities between Jeremiah and Moses. First of all, both of them were not well-spoken. That's why we believe that Moses even was a stammerer or a stutterer. And Jeremiah also claimed to not be well-spoken. They both initially tried to deny God's call to their ministry. They both prophesied exactly 40 years. Remember, Moses wasn't called to start prophesying until he was 80 years old, and then he died when he was 120. Well, luckily, I have some wonderful scholars who did all that legwork for me, but I didn't. You can do it yourself, but you don't get a pure, you know, go to Jeremiah and just say, okay, this year and then end that year. You have to go do a lot of legwork to go work out all the dates and figure it all out, but it's all been done, and Jeremiah prophesied exactly 40 years, just like Moses. They were both castaways. They were both betrayed by their own tribe. And they were both delivered by a servant, one by a handmaiden, one by a servant. So interesting, there's an interesting analogy there from the from Moses' life and Jeremiah's life that's pretty interesting. And then it gets even more in depth than that, but let's just track a couple of these down, take a look at them. I thought it was pretty fun. So let's go to Exodus. Chapter 4, verse 10. And it says, then Moses said to the Lord, please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither recently nor in time past, nor since thou hast spoken to thy servant, for I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. We don't need to go into what, you know, the rebuke was, but you know, eventually Moses is going to do the ministry God's called him to. And so it's real interesting there that, you know, Moses calls attention to that. And then if you go to Jeremiah 1:6.
You know, I'm going to create a standard for Bibles so that no matter how big they are, how small they are, what type font, the same things have to be on the same page of every different type of Bible.
Okay. Good luck with that.
Yeah. See, this one is numbered straight through, and the others are numbered Old and New Testament.
I have no plans.
Okay, Jeremiah 1:6. Oh, this is supposed to make you, it's got to go, you got to be a real keen on your books of the Bible and the order.
Oh,
it's Isaiah, then Jeremiah.
Oh, there we go. Okay. I was leaning on on Dad's arm, I couldn't get to that part of my body.
All right, so Jeremiah 1:6. Then I said, "Alas, Lord God, behold, I do not know how to speak, because I am a youth." So, you know, you have there, again, you know, you have that little analogy there between them. Let's look at this prophecy 40 years part. Let's just do, we'll pick a few select ones in here.
I think Moses just, probably both of them just use that excuse, because when you read in Acts about Moses, it says Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action.
Yeah.
So, you know, and you know, that's when God got mad at him, when he found out, you know, you're just making excuses. You don't want to do this.
Yeah. Kind of like Jonah.
Yeah.
I'm
more softer than Jonah, but
yeah.
Nevertheless, he just made these excuses up.
And I bet I'd be right there with him making excuses myself.
Yeah. I'm so busy.
I'm working on that Bible standard.
You were born in America, but you really want to go back to a place where you
but
were.
But I don't want you to.
All right, let's look at Exodus 7:7. This one's easy to do. The Bible here is very clear, and it makes the math real easy for us. Always you can do some simple subtraction or addition or something. Put all this together pretty easily. So 7:7, you'll see, and Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh. So remember, he was 80 years old when he spoke to Pharaoh. That was the beginning of his prophesying. Remember, he prophesied from then and until they were released from Egypt, right? And then he prophesied to the people of Egypt. In other words, remember, prophecy is not just telling the future. It is not telling the future.
It's speaking the word of God.
Speaking a word from the Lord. Like, this is what God says. It might be speaking something into the present, into your very current situation. That's prophecy. So we have prophets at Bethany Christian Church. There are prophets that, you know, and sometimes you're a prophet and you don't even know it. Because you might have, by divine inspiration, just decided, out of nowhere, just to say something to someone one day. And maybe they didn't even tell you. But that thing that you spoke to them, that to you was just a trivial anecdote or some sort of just making conversation, to them, it was the very thing that they'd been praying about and thinking about and wondering about and asking God about. And you said something to them that just clicked in their mind, and they thought, yes, that's, you know, thank you, Lord, for that. And in other words, without even knowing it, you may have prophesied to someone or another during your life as a Christian. So, let's look at this in Deuteronomy 34, verse 7.
I have it here for you.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Moses was 120 years old when he died. His sight was unimpaired, and his vigor had not abated.
So 120, do the math, 120 minus 80, he prophesied 40 years. Right? So now let's go look at Jeremiah. If you look at that, it's actually in Jeremiah 1:3, and that's the only reference I gave you, but you have to even get into some secular history in order to work it all out and figure it all out. That's partly why I never even thought of this before, is because, you know, it's just not very clear. You have to kind of dig a little bit deeper to find some of this stuff. But in Jeremiah 1:3, it says, "It came about in the days of Jehoiakim." Remember, that's the father of Jehoiachin, the one who was Jeconiah or Keniah. So this is his father. "The son of Josiah, king of Judah, until the end of the 11th year of Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, the king of Judah, until the exile of Jerusalem in the 5th month." Okay. You go work all that out, and it works out to 40 years. Just trust me.
You know, we're taking your word for that.
I'm putting a little question mark in there.
Yeah, put a question mark.
We want you to work this out on your own and report to us next Monday.
Yeah. Anybody want to take that assignment?
Fine. I came up with 39 years, 8 months.
All right.
Yeah, I have trouble with Moses in 40 years because they were in the wilderness 40 years, and that means all the stuff that took place in Egypt must have taken place one day.
Well, or one, it didn't take that long.
Within one year,
yeah. Yeah. And then basically, I saw the funniest cartoon where finally Moses' wife is seen going over to a caravan, and she says, "Don't let my husband hear, but just give me the directions." Or something like, Moses wouldn't ask for directions. Yeah.
That's a good one.
Stop it.
That's why we have garments now. He didn't have to. He followed the cloud and the pillar of fire.
All right, let's look at this next one here. Castaways. We don't need to read the Exodus one. That's pretty obvious. That's when Moses was. You know, it's the beginning of Exodus when they have. You know, they're going to catch the fact that they've allowed this boy to live, and so his mother tries to formulate a plan to allow for his survival, and so they put him in the little basket or ark and send him on his way. So in Jeremiah, though, it's interesting because if you look in Jeremiah 38, verse 6, it says, "Then they took Jeremiah and cast him into the cistern of Malchijah, the king's son, which was in the court of the guardhouse, and they let Jeremiah down with ropes. Now in the cistern there was no water, but only mud, and Jeremiah sank into the mud." And of course he was saved, and we can look at that. You know, notice in Exodus 2:5, "Delivered by handmaid," that's when the handmaid of Pharaoh's court found Moses.
Pharaoh's daughter.
Right. And then Jeremiah 38:7-10, which is right where we're at. "But Ehud Melech of the Ethiopian, a eunuch," so a eunuch is a servant, right? That's where I'm getting that from. "While he was in the king's palace, heard that they had put Jeremiah in the cistern. Now the king was sitting in the gate of Benjamin, and Ebed-Melech went out from the king's palace and spoke to the king, saying, 'My lord, the king, these men have acted wickedly in all that they have done to Jeremiah the prophet, whom they have cast into the cistern, and he will die right where he is because of the famine, for there is no more bread in the city.' Then the king commanded Ebed-Melech the Ethiopian, saying, 'Take 30 men from here under your own authority and bring up Jeremiah the prophet from the cistern before he dies.'"
Mine says take 3 men.
3?
Yes.
30. This one's right.
That, I'm going to write to the editors.
Mine says 30, is that right?
Yes. Yours, what does that 30. Say? Take 3 men with you from here.
What you got?
I got it on sale. It's a revised
new
standard.
New revised standard.
No, but that's an error. That's an error.
Well, even this one on sale at Sam's says 30 men.
But anyway, the point being, notice it was also a king's court, just like Pharaoh, right? You know, a servant of the king's court saved him. So you have all those interesting analogies. Let's go look at that second one from the bottom, betrayed by his own tribe. That one, real quick. So that's in Numbers 16:1-2. This is a relatively famous account of the rebellion of Korah. says, now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, so he was a Levite, just like Moses was a Levite, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took action. And they rose up before Moses together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, chosen in the assembly, men of renown. And they assembled together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, you have gone far enough, for all the congregation are holy, even one of them, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst, so why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? So, you know, right there, that's a rebellion of Korah, and that's a, well, I suppose that there's a Catholic or two out there that's probably used that to denounce Protestant mentality, because Korah is quickly rebuked and swallowed up by the sand in subsequent verses. And notice what he says, the whole assembly is holy, right? Who are you to exalt? Who are you to be the spokesman? Why can't I be the spokesman? Or why can't, you know, and that's kind of, that is the product, more of the Protestant line of thought. So, interesting. I wouldn't say that's a valid argument against Protestantism, but just say you might want to watch out for that one. And then in Jeremiah 12:6, back to Jeremiah. For even your brothers in the household of your father, even they have dealt treacherously with you. And so that's that little hint there that Jeremiah is betrayed by his own family. And so let's, there's another one, and I don't have it in here. I can't believe I didn't put it, but I must have overlooked putting that in, or maybe it was on one that didn't get updated, maybe, that it's before I printed it. But let me just find it real quick, and I'll give it to you so you can write it in. It's let me just make sure I got it right before I tell you.
We saw the strangest thing coming back to that. Coming up, and we saw some dogs in the road. One had been run over or hurt, and the other dog picked it up, and the other little dog was helping him, and they got it off the road.
Oh, my God.
Huh. It was by the entrance to one of those ranch houses on the way off. It was those, you know, the big gates that were sitting there. Somebody had run over one of the dogs, and the other one went out in the street right in front of us.
Wow.
To pick it up and move it.
So I wouldn't hit the other little dog, but he was picking it up to carry it off the road.
Wow. And they both trotted off with it up to the house.
Oh,
the
dog.
Never seen anything like that.
No.
Before. Take care.
We were driving the other night, and a little white-tailed deer was on the road, and Flo said, get out of the way, little bunny. said that. That happens to be a deer, and she goes.
And now without glasses, just think, oh, yeah.
What I'm wondering about is who's going to drive when I get sleepy.
Because you want to get sleepy. What is the topic?
I'm gonna have to look it up.
That's okay. We can get it next time.
We'll get it next time. But it's the last piece that links Jeremiah to Jesus, or you know, to being something to do with the messianic prophecies, and that's actually where this belief came from, that Jeremiah was going to be. There was actually a tradition and a belief that Jeremiah was going to come back before the Messiah, and it's or had something to do with the Messiah because it's linked. And I can't believe I left it off because that was the highlight of it.
It's because you wanted to get us all excited about next week.
Yeah, you got to come back tune in next week, right?
In Revelation, a lot of people think that the two prophets had come back and come back alive are Elijah and Jeremiah.
Right.
I've heard that also.
I mean, it doesn't really say, but
yeah,
since it kind of says that, you know, they...
So... let's go ahead and move on.
It's almost 8, isn't it?
Right.
Okay.
Well, okay.
Here's just another. I think this originally meant to be before the chart there. Yeah, that Luke one and the Matthew one below it were both meant to be
above
the chart. I apologize about that. Let's go ahead and look at them real quick, and then we'll close because they're pretty quick, and we already pretty much covered it, but I'll just show you some of the scriptures. So we're going to look at Luke 22, verse 70, through
23.
That's page
158.
If the standard's in place.
Once the standard's in place, it's going to be so easy.
Luke 22.
Right here,
23 through 23. Oh, I got it. Sorry. Luke 22. 70,
verse
70. And they all said, "Are you the Son of God then?" And he said to them, "Yes, I am." And they said, "What further need do we have of testimony? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth."
And read the next three verses. Starting chapter 23.
The whole body of them arose and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding him to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ the King." And Pilate asked him, saying, "Are you the King of the Jews?" And he answered him and said, It is as you say."
All right, thank you.
So there says something real different. He said to them, "Not yes, but you say that I am."
Yeah, and that is accurate. In other words, he's saying, you say. Yeah. So you say. But the interesting part is, you know, they ask him, are you the Son of God then? And he said to them, yes, I am. And so, you know, he pronounced himself to be the Son of God and then later on the Messiah. You know, so there's another picture of that. And then we already looked at...
In the King James it says, thou sayest it.
Right. Like thou sayest it, like you said it.
You are right, it says in this one. You are right in saying that I am.
Right. And so, we already looked, the next bullet down, we already looked at Matthew 14:33, that's the one where he was walking on water and they called him the Son of God. But if you go ahead and go back and look at Matthew 2:2 real quick. Matthew chapter 2, verse 2. It says, where is he who has been born King of the Jews? That's the first mention where, in the New Testament, where he's called the King of the Jews, the Jewish Messiah. So, that had come before. People, you know, the Magi, these mysterious wise men from the East, they knew that he was the King of the Jews. And then if you look at John 1:41.
Well, this Bible has the Apocrypha in between the Old and New Testament. I'm always always tripping over it.
And so you need to buy these new
tabs. I cheat. Yeah. You know what? Look at my tabs.
They're wonderful.
Okay, John 1. Okay, John. It's John 1:41. This is interesting. So he was called the King of the Jews, and then here. Notice right at the very beginning. This is very, very early. He found first his own brother. This is Andrew, right? He is Andrew. He found first his own brother, Simon, that's Peter, and said to him, we have found the Messiah. So they were already proclaiming him to be the Messiah, right? But then that's why that was supposed to come before the chart and before that other bullet there, where it kind of goes and says, you know, but who do you say that I am? Mm-hmm. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And the Son of Man. In other words, you're it. You're the fulcrum point on which all of reality and all of existence, the balance is all on you. So I think we'll go ahead and just stop there. I will find the Jeremiah reference. I'm sorry about that. I can't.
Well, I can't wait till you find it, so that's something to look forward to.
So it's linked to Isaiah 53, which is very popular, very well known, Isaiah 53, one of the most famous chapters. But it's, if you look in Jeremiah, there's a link to it. And we'll start there next week, and then we will move on to John's chapter 6, 44 and 65, that the 1, 2, 3, 4th bullet from the bottom, and we'll be about halfway through. And we're going to talk about... We're going to talk about the rock, where he calls Peter, you know, blessed are you, Simon, Peter, for flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and I'm giving you the keys, the kingdom of heaven.
And then you should have an infinite number of popes come after you.
Right, we'll talk about all that kind of stuff, and I think I'm going to try to aim, instead of being a real Catholic basher next week, that's not my goal, I'm going to try to give you a pretty balanced perspective on what some of the Catholics think about this verse, what Protestants think, and I think there's somewhere in there, there's some middle ground that I think is probably the more accurate truth.
Let me take 2 minutes.
Sure, go ahead.
You inspired me to look up something. I think you'll enjoy this too. How Words Are Invented by Joe Carter.
It's short, right?
It's fairly short. Why are prolific neologists like Milton, Chaucer, and Shakespeare praised for coining new words, while Sarah Palin is mocked for inventing a term like repudiate?
Gene Byatt, the Provost and Professor of Literature at Patrick Henry College.